Chapter 19. The Death of the Abbé. Now that this treasure, which had so long been the object of the Abbé's meditations, could ensure the future happiness of him whom Faria really loved as a son, it had doubled its value in his eyes, and every day he expatiated on the amount, explaining to Dantès all the good which, with 13 or 14 millions of francs, a man could do in these days to his friends. And then Dante's countenance became gloomy, for the oath of vengeance he had taken recurred to his memory, and he reflected how much ill in these times a man with 13 or 14 millions could do to his enemies. The abbé did not know the Isle of Monte Cristo, but Dantès knew it, and had often passed it, situated 25 miles from Pianosa, between Corsica and the Isle of Elba, and had once touched at it. This island was, always had been, and still is, completely deserted. It is a rock of almost conical form, which seems as though produced by some volcanic effort from the depth to the surface of the ocean. Dantès traced a plan of the island to Faria, and Faria gave Dantès advice as to the means he should employ to recover the treasure. But Dantès was far from being as enthusiastic and confident as the old man. It was past a question now that Faria was not a lunatic, and the way in which he had achieved the discovery, which had given rise to the suspicion of his madness, increased his admiration of him. But at the same time he could not believe that that deposit, supposing it had ever existed, still existed, and though he considered the treasure as by no means chimerical, he yet believed it was no longer there. However, as if fate resolved on depriving the prisoners of their last chance, and making them understand that they were condemned to perpetual imprisonment, a new misfortune befell them. The gallery on the seaside, which had long been in ruins, was rebuilt. They had repaired it completely, and stopped up, with vast masses of stone, the hole Dantès had partly filled in. But for this precaution, which it will be remembered the abbé had made to Edmund, the misfortune would have been still greater, for their attempt to escape would have been detected, and they would undoubtedly have been separated. Thus a fresh and even stronger door was closed upon them. "You see," said the young man, with an air of sorrowful resignation to Faria, "that God deems it right to take from me even what you call my devotion to you. I have promised you to remain for ever with you. And now I could not break my promise if I would. I shall no more have the treasure than you, and neither of us will quit this prison. But my real treasure is not that, my dear friend, which awaits me beneath the sombre rocks of Monte Cristo, but it is your presence, our living together 5 or 6 hours a day, in spite of our jailers. It is those rays of intelligence you have elicited from my brain, the languages you have implanted in my memory, and which spring there with all their philological ramifications. These different sciences that you have made so easy to me by the depth of the knowledge you possess of them, and the clearness of the principles to which you have reduced them, this is my treasure, my beloved friend, and with this you have made me rich and happy. Believe me, and take comfort, this is better for me than tons of gold and cases of diamonds, even were they not as problematical as the clouds we see in the morning floating over the sea, which we take for terra firma, and which evaporate and vanish as we draw near to them. To have you as long as possible near me, to hear your eloquent voice, which I trust embellishes my mind, strengthens my soul, and makes my whole frame capable of great and terrible things if I should ever be free, so fills my whole existence, that the despair to which I was just on the point of yielding when I knew you has no longer any hold over me. And this my fortune, not chimerical, but actual. I owe you my real good, my present happiness, and all the sovereigns of the earth, were they César Borgias, could not deprive me of this." Thus, if not actually happy, yet the days these two unfortunates passed together went quickly. Faria, who for so long a time had kept silence as to the treasure, now perpetually talked of it. As he had said, he remained paralysed in the right arm and the left leg, and had given up all hope of ever enjoying it himself. But he was continually thinking over some means of escape for his young companion, and he enjoyed it for him. For fear the letter might be some day lost or abstracted, he compelled Dantès to learn it by heart, and he thus knew it from one end to the other. Then he destroyed the second portion, assured that if the first were seized, no one would be able to penetrate its real meaning. Whole hours sometimes passed whilst Faria was giving instructions to Dantes, instructions which were to serve him when he was at liberty. Then, once free, from the day and hour and moment when he was so, he could have but one only thought, which was to gain Monte Cristo by some means, and remain there alone under some pretext, which would give no suspicions, and once there to endeavour to find the wonderful caverns, and search in the appointed spot. The appointed spot, be it remembered, being the farthest angle in the second opening. In the meanwhile the hours passed, if not rapidly, at least tolerably. Faria, as we have said, without having recovered the use of his hand and foot, had resumed all the clearness of his understanding, and had gradually, besides the moral instructions we have detailed, taught his youthful companion the patient and sublime duty of a prisoner, who learns to make something from nothing. They were thus perpetually employed, Faria that he might not see himself grow old, Dantes for fear of recalling the almost extinct past, which now only floated in his memory like a distant light wandering in the night. All went on as if in existences in which misfortune has deranged nothing, and which glide on mechanically and tranquilly beneath the eye of Providence. But beneath this superficial calm, there were in the heart of the young man, and perhaps in that of the old man, many repressed desires, many stifled sighs, which found vent when Faria was left alone, and when Edmund returned to his cell. One night Edmund awoke suddenly, believing he had heard someone calling him. He opened his eyes and tried to perceive through the gloom. His name, or rather a plaintive voice, which essayed to pronounce his name, reached him. "Alas," murmured Edmund, "can it be?" He moved his bed, drew up the stone, rushed into the passage, and reached the opposite extremity. The secret entrance was open. By the light of the wretched and wavering lamp of which we have spoken, Dantes saw the old man, pale but yet erect, clinging to the bedstead. His features were writhing with those horrible symptoms which he already knew, and which had so seriously alarmed him when he saw them for the first time.
"Alas, my dear friend!" said Faria in a resigned tone. "You understand, do you not? And I need not attempt to explain to you."
Edmund uttered a cry of agony, and, quite out of his senses, rushed towards the door, exclaiming, "Help! Help!" Faria had just sufficient strength to retain him.
"Silence!" he said. "Or you are lost! Think now of yourself! Only, my dear friend, act so as to render your captivity supportable or your flight possible. It would require years to renew only what I have done here, and which would be instantly destroyed if our jailers knew we had communicated with each other. Besides, be assured, my dear Edmund, the dungeon I am about to leave will not long remain empty. Some other unfortunate being will soon take my place, and to him you will appear like an angel of salvation. Perhaps he will be young, strong, and enduring like yourself, and will aid you in your escape, whilst I have been but a hindrance. You will no longer have half a dead body tied to you to paralyze all your movements. At length Providence has done something for you. He restores to you more than he takes away, and it was time I should die."
Edmund could only clasp his hands and exclaim, "Oh, my friend, speak not thus!" And then, resuming all his presence of mind, which had for a moment staggered under this blow, and his strength, which had failed at the words of the old man, he said, "Oh, I have saved you once, and I will save you a second time." And raising the foot of the bed, he drew out the phial, still a third filled with the red liquor. "See," he exclaimed, "there remains still some of this saving draught. Quick, quick, tell me what I must do this time. Are there any fresh instructions? Speak, my friend, I listen."
"There is not a hope," replied Faria, shaking his head. "But no matter. God wills it that man, whom he has created, and in whose heart he has so profoundly rooted the love of life, should do all in his power to preserve that existence which, however painful it may be, is yet always so dear."
"Oh, yes, yes," exclaimed Dantes, "and I tell you, you shall be saved."
"Well, then, try. The cold gains upon me. I feel the blood flowing towards my brain. This horrible trembling which makes my teeth chatter and seems to dislocate my bones begins to pervade my whole frame. In 5 minutes the malady will reach its height, and in a quarter of an hour there will be nothing left of me but a dead corpse. "Oh!" exclaimed Dantès, his heart wrung with anguish. "Do as you did before, only do not wait so long. All the springs of life are now exhausted in me, and death," he continued, looking at his paralyzed arm and leg, "has but half its work to do. If, after having made me swallow 12 drops instead of 10, you see that I do not recover, then pour the rest down my throat. Now lift me on my bed, for I can no longer support myself."
Edmund took the old man in his arms and laid him on the bed.
"And now, my dear friend," said Varia, "sole consolation of my wretched existence, you whom heaven gave me somewhat late, but still gave me a priceless gift, and for which I am most grateful, at the moment of separating from you forever, I wish you all the happiness and all the prosperity you so well deserve. My son, I bless thee."
The young man cast himself on his knees, leaning his head against the old man's bed.
"Listen now to what I say in this my dying moment. The treasure of the Spadas exists. God grants me that there no longer exists for me distance or obstacle. I see it in the depths of the inner cavern. My eyes pierce the inmost recesses of the earth and are dazzled at the sight of so much riches. If you do escape, remember that the poor abbé, whom all the world called mad, was not so. Hasten to Monte Cristo. Avail yourself of the fortune, for you have indeed suffered long enough."
A violent shock interrupted the young man. Dantès raised his head and saw Faria's eyes injected with blood. It seemed as if a flow of blood had ascended from the chest to the head.
"Adieu! Adieu!"
murmured the old man, clasping Edmund's hand convulsively.
"Adieu!"
"Oh, no, no, not yet," he cried. "Do not forsake me. Oh, succour him! Help, help, help!"
"Hush, hush," murmured the dying man, "that they may not separate us if you save me."
"You are right. Oh, yes, yes, be assured I shall save you. Besides, although you suffer much, you do not seem in such agony as before."
"Do not mistake. I suffer less because there is in me less strength to endure it. At your age we have faith in life. It is the privilege of youth to believe and hope. But old men see death more clearly. Oh, 'tis here, 'tis here, 'tis over. My sight is gone. My reason escapes. Your hand, Dantès. Adieu. Adieu."
And raising himself by a final effort in which he summoned all his faculties, he said,
"Monte Cristo! Forget not Monte Cristo!"
And he fell back in his bed. The crisis was terrible. His twisted limbs, his swollen eyelids, a foam of blood and froth in his lips, a frame quite rigid was soon extended on this bed of agony in place of the intellectual being who was there but so lately. Dantès took the lamp, placed it on a projecting stone above the bed, whence its tremulous light fell with strange and fantastic ray on this discomposed countenance and this motionless and stiffened body. With fixed eyes he awaited boldly the moment for administering the hoped-for restorative. When he believed the instant had arrived, he took the knife, unclosed the teeth, which offered less resistance than before, counted one after the other 12 drops, and watched. The phial contained perhaps twice as much more. He waited 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour, half an hour. Nothing moved. Trembling, his hair erect, his brow bathed with perspiration, he counted the seconds by the beatings of his heart. Then he thought it was time to make the last trial, and he put the phial to the violet lips of Faria, and without having occasion to force open his jaws, which had remained extended, he poured the whole of the liquid down his throat. The draught produced a galvanic effect. A violent trembling pervaded the old man's limbs. His eyes opened until it was fearful to gaze upon them. He heaved a sigh which resembled a shriek, and then all this vibrating frame returned gradually to its state of immobility, only the eyes remaining open. Half an hour. An hour. An hour and a half elapsed, and during this time of anguish Edmund leaned over his friend, his hand applied to his heart, and felt the body gradually grow cold and the heart's pulsation become more and more deep and dull, until at length all stopped. The last movement of the heart ceased. The face became livid, the eyes remained open, but the look was glazed. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. The dawn was just breaking, and its weak ray came into the dungeon and paled the ineffectual light of the lamp. Singular shadows passed over the countenance of the dead man, which at times gave it the appearance of life. Whilst this struggle between day and night lasted, Dantès still doubted, but as soon as the daylight gained the preeminence, he saw that he was alone with a corpse. Then an invincible and extreme terror seized upon him, and he dared not again press the hand that hung out of bed. He dared no longer to gaze on those fixed and vacant eyes which he tried many times to close, but in vain. They opened again as soon as shut. He extinguished the lamp, carefully concealed it, and then went away, closing as well as he could the entrance to the secret passage by the large stone as he descended. It was time, for the jailer was coming. On this occasion he began his rounds at Dante's cell, and on leaving him he went on to Faria's dungeon, where he was taking breakfast and some linen. Nothing betokened that the man knew anything of what had occurred. He went on his way. Dantès was then seized with an indescribable desire to know what was going on in the dungeon of his unfortunate friend. He therefore returned by the subterraneous gallery, and arrived in time to hear the exclamations of the turnkey, who called out for help. Other turnkeys came, and then was heard the regular tramp of soldiers, even when not on duty. Behind them came the governor. Edmund heard the creaking of the bed in which they were moving the corpse, heard the voice of the governor, who desired them to throw water on the face, and seeing that in spite of this application the prisoner did not recover, sent for the doctor. The governor then went out, and some words of pity fell on Dante's listening ears, mingled with brutal laughter.
"Well, well," said one, "the madman has gone to look after his treasure. Good journey to him."
"With all his millions, he will not have enough to pay for his shroud," said another.
"Oh," added a third voice, "the shrouds of the Chateau d'If are not dear."
"Perhaps," said one of the previous speakers, "as he was a churchman, they may go to some expense in his behalf."
"They may give him the honours of the sack."
Edmund did not lose a word, but comprehended very little of what was said. The voices soon ceased, and it seemed to him as if the persons had all left the cell. Still he dared not to enter, as they might have left some turnkey to watch the dead. He remained, therefore, mute and motionless, restraining even his respiration. At the end of an hour he heard a faint noise, which increased. It was the governor who returned, followed by the doctor and other attendants. There was a moment's silence. It was evident that the doctor was examining the dead body. The inquiries soon commenced. The doctor analysed the symptoms of the malady under which the prisoner had sunk, and declared he was dead. Questions and answers followed in a manner that made Dantès indignant, for he felt that all the world should experience for the poor abbé the love he bore him.
"I'm very sorry for what you tell me," said the governor, replying to the assurance of the doctor, "that the old man is really dead, for he was a quiet, inoffensive prisoner, happy in his folly, and required no watching."
"Ah!" added the turnkey, "there was no occasion for watching him. He would have stayed here 50 years, I'll answer for it, without any attempt to escape."
"Still," said the governor, "I believe it will be requisite, notwithstanding your certainty, and not that I doubt your science, but for my own responsibility's sake, that we should be perfectly assured that the prisoner is dead."
There was a moment of complete silence, during which Dantès, still listening, felt assured that the doctor was examining and touching the corpse a second time.
"You may make your mind easy," said the doctor. "He is dead. I will answer for that."
"You know, sir," said the governor, persisting, "that we are not content in such cases as this with such a simple examination. In spite of all appearances, be so kind, therefore, as finish your duty by fulfilling the formalities prescribed by law."
"Let the irons be heated," said the doctor. "But really it is a useless precaution."
This order to heat the irons made Dantès shudder. He heard hasty steps, the creaking of a door, people going and coming, and some minutes afterwards a turnkey entered, saying,
"Here is the brazier lighted."
There was a moment's silence, and then was heard the noise made by burning flesh, of which the peculiar and nauseous smell penetrated even behind the wall where Dantes was listening, horrified. At this smell of human flesh carbonized, the damp came over the young man's brow, and he felt as if he should faint.
"You see, sir, he is really dead," said the doctor. "This burn in the heel is decisive. The poor fool is cured of his folly and delivered from his captivity."
"Wasn't his name Farrier?"
inquired one of the officers who accompanied the governor.
"Yes, sir, and as he said, it was an ancient name. He was too very learned and rational enough on all points which did not relate to his treasure. But on that, indeed, he was obstinate."
"It is the sort of malady which we call monomania," said the doctor.
"You had never anything to complain of?"
said the governor to the jailer who had charge of the abbey.
"Never, sir," replied the jailer. "Never. On the contrary, he sometimes amused me very much by telling me stories. One day, too, when my wife was ill, he gave me a prescription which cured her."
Ah,
said the doctor.
"I was ignorant that I had a competitor. But I hope, Monsieur le Gouverneur, that you will show him all proper respect in consequence."
Yes, make your mind easy. He shall be decently interred in the newest sack we can find. Will that satisfy you?"
"Must we do this last formality in your presence, sir?" inquired a turnkey.
"Certainly, but make haste. I cannot stay here all day."
Fresh footsteps going and coming were now heard, and a moment afterwards the noise of cloth being rubbed reached Dante's ears. The bed creaked on its hinges, and the heavy foot of a man who lifts a weight resounded on the floor. Then the bed again creaked under the weight deposited upon it.
"In the evening," said the governor.
"Will there be any mass?" asked one of the attendants.
"That is impossible," replied the governor. "The chaplain of the chateau came to me yesterday to beg for leave of absence in order to take a trip to Hyères for a week. I told him I would attend to the prisoners in his absence. If the poor abbé had not been in such a hurry, he might have had his requiem."
"Pooh!"
said the doctor, with the accustomed impiety of persons in his profession.
"He is a churchman. God will respect his profession, and not give the devil the wicked delight of sending him a priest."
A shout of laughter followed this brutal jest. During this time the operation of putting the body in the sack was going on.
"This evening," said the governor, when the task was ended.
"At what o'clock?" inquired a turnkey.
"Why, about 10 or 11 o'clock."
"Shall we watch by the corpse?"
"Of what use would it be? Shut the dungeon as if he were alive, that is all."
Then the steps retreated, and the voices died away in the distance. The noise of the door, with its creaking hinges and bolts, ceased, and a silence duller than any solitude ensued, the silence of death, which pervaded all, and struck its icy chill through the young man's whole frame. Then he raised the flagstone cautiously with his head, and looked carefully round the chamber. It was empty, and Dantes, quitting the passage, entered it.